dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse.
The vague and unspecific promise of a better tomorrow is all that politicians have left to offer. It is only with this system of unfettered capitalism that they promise us the brighter future that awaits us, our brave new world. This is the future of the current system. This is the future of obedience.
From somebody else.
You cannot have an economic system that concentrates wealth and expect to have a political system which distributes power.
You're listening to episode 670 of Unwelcome Guests, Thinking Clearly About the Vast Machine. I'm Robin Upton, and we've just heard a couple of thoughts from Chris Hedges and Robert Jensen, respectively, both of whom we'll be hearing later on in the show, on what David Graeber refers to as the vast machine to perpetuate hopelessness. Is it really true that the socio-economic political system of corporate capitalism somehow represents a high point in human development, and that no real change is to be expected in the short, medium, or long term? If the very idea strikes you as preposterous, then I wonder, have you got an answer as to just why so many people find it difficult to consider life after capitalism? I think it's David Graeber who reminds us some people find it easier to consider the end of the world than to consider the end of capitalism. This week, a range of familiar speakers on the show give their angle on understanding the vast machine to perpetuate hopelessness and on what to do about it. We begin with Unwelcome Guests member Kenneth Doust. This is from his radio show, New World Notes, from earlier this year.
British photographer and filmmaker Temujin Duran has made a new film called Obey, How the Rise of Mass Propaganda Killed Populism. The audio is very good. He reads selections from Chris Hedges' 2010 book, The Death of the Liberal Class, with some background music. It really puts today's newspaper headlines in context.
At any given moment, there is an orthodoxy, a body of ideas which it is assumed that all right-thinking people will accept without question. It is not exactly forbidden to say this, that, or the other, but it is not done to say it. Just as in mid-Victorian times, it was not done to mention trousers in the presence of a lady. We are an animal of habit. We live, fight, we bleed, and ultimately die for our habits. And those very habits shape the world around us and dictate how we might lead our lives. Before long, it soon becomes difficult to shift our behaviour from anything that we are not familiar with. This is a film about you, me, and the routine of obedience. It is an attempt to show what it means to be obedient in a time where our habits will ultimately shape a world in which we will no longer wish to live. The world as it is today is a place where companies have replaced countries. It is no longer the governments of countries that decide how things run and how people live. Instead, prime ministers have been replaced by directors, presidents with CEOs, parliaments with board members, and civil servants with business strategists. Dominant shareholders drive policies, not constituents. Former world leaders leave administrations to return to work for banks or giant investment firms, whilst we scout for the next generation of politicians from successful corporations, as if to imply that running a profitable company is like representing and deciding how people are to live their lives. It was not long ago that we saw big businessmen as people to be wary of, but somehow we have invited them to lead our countries. We unite behind brands, behind celebrities rather than behind nations. We have become more than nation states. We are corporation states. But how did this happen? At what point did business replace government? Unregulated capitalism had proved itself to be deeply flawed in the Great Depression. So why is it everywhere today? The war effort in the 1940s created a demand for big business to manufacture bombs, tanks, aircraft, and all manner of other war materials. Many companies adjusted their assembly lines to suit the needs of war. It was highly profitable. The war also unleashed radical new forms of mass propaganda that made it possible to engineer public opinion. There were revolutions in radio, cinema, photography, cheap mass publications and graphic art. This new propaganda exploited recent understandings of mass psychology and its pioneers like Sigmund Freud. Their works became the basis of communication and how individuals would interact with each other. War propaganda was churned out to rally people against a cause, to unite a country, and get citizens behind the war effort. As the war persisted, corporate profits boosted the US economy, and people began to readdress their criticism of the capitalist system. But the war also destroyed long-held values and self-perceptions that had once characterized contemporary life. It replaced them with fear, distrust, and the hedonism of the consumer society. Before the 1940s, there existed many mass movements enraged by the abuses of business. But this new propaganda drove any and all competing ideas and values underground. It vilified all who did not speak in the language of business and state. War propaganda not only bolstered support of the war, but also discredited dissidents and reformers as traitors. This rise of mass propaganda effectively killed populism. It began the death of the traditionally liberal forces that could offer a resistance to the capitalist machine. For this mass propaganda to work, the state could not do it alone. They hired corporations to help them talk to the people. The origins of all modern advertisement, all mass communications, has its foundations in war. And as the Second World War drew to a close, big business, anxious to maintain their high wartime profits, eagerly looked on to where the next conflict might emerge. To ensure financial security during the Cold War, giant US corporations began to split their manufacturing lines throughout the US to provide as many jobs in as many states as possible. In this way, they had a powerful influence over the government. No member of Congress would risk action against a corporation that provides high number of jobs to people in their constituency for fear of a voter backlash. So these businesses could essentially control the way in which Congress would make decisions and choose how policy would be made to favor a corporate profit. This was a huge advance in the privatization of the US government, and from here on, priorities were increasingly made according to what was good for corporations rather than what was good for the people. Government media began to be replaced with corporate media. The quaint literary serials, local reports, town debates, and other forms of popular expression vanished from newspapers. It was replaced by celebrity gossip, the new angry rhetoric of the Cold War, and nationally syndicated columns. Papers became commercialized and centralized. The business of mass propaganda also brought in vast sums of advertising revenue to the media. But corporate and government propaganda narrowed the parameters of acceptable debate. It began the consolidation of the press by huge companies that would end with nearly everything we see, hear, and read disseminated from roughly half a dozen corporations. And for all of Rupert Murdoch's talk of ending the reign of the elites, he presided over the rise of media monopolization. It turned the news into the elite's echo chamber. Today, the privatization of government functions is enormous. In the United States, there are 18 military and civilian intelligence agencies, and 70% of their combined budget is outsourced to corporations. The Pentagon has privatized 69% of its workforce. The Afghanistan war effort is almost wholly privatized. Businesses now run wars and play more part in international conflicts than any state does. Corporations have 35,000 lobbyists in Washington and thousands more in state capitals that dole out corporate money to shape and write legislation. They use committees to solicit employees and shareholders for huge donations in order to fund business-friendly politicians. It is now a global practice, from the Politburo of China to the British Parliament. Labour leaders make lavish salaries and are considered junior partners within corporate capitalism, as long as they do not speak in the language of class struggle. Politicians, like generals, are loyal to the demands of the corporate state in power. They retire to become millionaires as lobbyists or company managers. Artists who use their talents to foster the myths and illusions that bombard our society live comfortably in the Hollywood Hills. Journalists who prize access to the powerful more than they prize the truth report lies and propaganda to propel us into wars around the world. Education has experienced a similar corporate takeover. Suffering from cuts in government funding, these institutions have transformed themselves into vocational schools. They have become breeding grounds for system managers trained to serve the corporate state. Many of these universities have swelled the budgets of their departments with millions in corporate money. University deans, paid enormous salaries as if they were heads of investment banks, are judged almost solely on their ability to raise money. The arts, just as hungry as the media for corporate money and sponsorship, refuse to address the social and economic disparities that create suffering for tens of millions of citizens. Commercial artists peddle mythical narratives, once propagated by corporations, self-help gurus, Oprah Winfrey and the Christian right, that if we dig deep enough within ourselves, focus on happiness, find our inner strength or believe in miracles, we can have everything we desire. We inhabit a system of inverted totalitarianism, the political coming of age of corporate power and the political demobilization of the citizen. Inverted totalitarianism differs from classical forms of totalitarianism, which revolve around a demagogue or charismatic leader. It finds its expression in the anonymity of the corporate state. The corporate forces behind inverted totalitarianism do not replace decaying structures with new revolutionary ones. They do not import new symbols or iconography as classic totalitarianism movements do. They do not offer a radical alternative. Corporate power claims to honor electoral politics, freedom and constitutions, but these corporate forces corrupt and manipulate power as to make democracy impossible. We have yet to fully grasp that corporations are not concerned with the common good. They exploit, pollute, impoverish, repress, kill and lie to make money. They throw poor families out of homes, let the uninsured die, wage useless wars to make profits, poison and pollute the ecosystem, slash social assistance programs, gut public education, trash the global economy, plunder the government treasuries and crush all popular movements that seek justice for working men and women. They worship money and power. Capitalism is a revolutionary force that consumes greater and greater numbers of human lives until finally it consumes itself, leaving nothing but a dead zone.
And I thought it would be helpful to take a break from Chris Hedges' reading there for another angle on capitalism as a revolutionary force. More in the system, possibly that much more accessible to a wider audience, is the following talk by Sat Chali.
Today, Media Education Foundation Director Sat Chali. He spoke at Greenfield Community College the 18th of November, 2009, on advertising and its relationship to the material culture that we exist within. Now, Sat Chali.
The title of my talk, it's about advertising, is called Advertising and the Perfect Storm, Global Warming, Peak Oil, and Consumer Debt. And I think we are actually at a kind of very unique moment in world history, not just American history, but in world history where these things are coming together. And what I want to draw attention to is the role of something that we normally don't look at. We normally think of as kind of idiotic or not very important, and that is advertising, or the propaganda system that is advertising. In my remarks today, I want to make a modest claim. I'll tell you what I want to do to start off with. My modest claim is that advertising is the most powerful and sustained system of propaganda in human history, and its cumulative cultural and political effects, unless very quickly checked, will be responsible for destroying the world as we know it. In the process of achieving this, the masters of the advertising system, global corporations bent on nothing but private profits, will be responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands, actually forget that, will be responsible for the deaths of millions of people, mostly non-Western. In addition, the peoples of the world will be prevented from achieving true happiness. Simply stated, our survival as a species is dependent upon minimizing the threat from advertising and the commercial culture that has spawned it. So I'm stating my claims boldly at the outset so there can be no doubt as to what is at stake in our debates about the media and culture at the start of the new millennium. Now, what's the basis of my outrageous claims? Initially, I would just point to the incredible presence of the advertising and commercial messages in our culture. I mean, just their presence. Ads are everywhere and colonizing more and more spaces almost by the minute. And I use the term colonizing because I think they're taking over. Space that wasn't about commercial discourse and about commercial speech is becoming commercial speech. And it is reaching into every nook and cranny of the culture. It is an imperializing discourse. And individual ads may appear banal, they may appear stupid, but those individual ads, they carry a very powerful single message. And I won't tell you what that is right now, we'll get to it. But I think every single ad that you see, in fact, is the carrier of a much, much broader ideology. And that ideology is what is the threat. For instance, our entire media system, television and print, has been developed as a delivery system for marketers. Of corporate media, of advertising-supported media, is not to deliver news to us, is not to deliver programming to us. The prime function of media is to deliver us to advertisers. Television gets 100% of its money from advertisers. And what they get in return is they get our eyeballs. The programming, the editorial content, it's all designed to essentially get us to look at something. And then that time and that attention can be sold. In television, where's the money come? You know, remember the old adage from All the President's Men, follow the money? You should always follow the money. In television, where does the money come from? 100% from advertisers. So I'm not even talking about the ads in between the programs. I'm talking about the programs themselves. That's why they look like they do. They are designed, in fact, to make sure that the ads work in the most effective way. Newspapers is about 80% comes from advertisers, 20% comes from subscribers. Magazines is anywhere from 50% to 80%. And more, the internet is moving towards total advertising control as well. That's what I mean by colonization. Look at the movie system. At one time, it was outside the direct influence of the broader marketing system. It is now fully integrated into it. With marketing tie-ins and especially with product placements, spaces that were once free of commercial control are now, in fact, part of that commercial system. In fact, going to the movies is, and you know, for advertisers, it's the perfect medium. You can't get up when you're in a movie theater. You can't get up and go to the bathroom. You can't go up and turn it off. You are a captive audience, which is what they want. Actually, one of the last captive audiences is in places like this, institutions like this, is in colleges and universities. And I'm pretty sure that we're not too far away from... I'm waiting to get the call from someone saying, would you mind wearing this T-shirt and we'll pay you a certain amount. As public funds are drained from the non-commercial cultural sector, art galleries, museums, and symphonies bid for corporate sponsorship. If you look at sports... Sports are now integrally tied up with sponsorship, whether it's through the namings of stadiums. Some of the most famous names in sports in terms of stadiums are now they're changing. It's no longer the Boston Garden; it's the Fleet Center or whatever it is now. Like, it also changes every time some company goes under. Look at baseball. If you want to see colonization of what I'm talking about, look at baseball. Okay, 10 years ago. No ads behind home plate. From the advertiser point of view, that is absolutely wasted. People are looking at the screen, and you're not selling their time. That's why you have ads behind home plate. So the baseball games have now become fully integrated into this. Even those institutions once thought to be outside of the market are being sucked in. High schools now sell the sides of their buses, the spaces of their hallways, and the classroom time of their students to hawkers of candy bars, soft drinks, and jeans. In many cities, sponsors are being sought for public playgrounds, actually for any space. As public funds dry up, corporate sponsors are there ready to provide the funding. In the contemporary world, everything is sponsored by someone. The latest plans of a company called Space Marketing Incorporated, and it's a company that exists. This is not some wild, fantasy or conspiracy. Space Marketing Incorporated call for rockets to deliver mile-wide Mylar billboards on which can be placed whatever logo you want. So as you go out, it's such a waste. All that beautiful blue sky could be used to sell. It's in the planning stages right now. Already, Pizza Hut is a logo on the side of the space shuttle. It's a Russian space shuttle, but the Americans, we haven't quite got to the Americans, but it's coming. It's an inevitable process. Pepsi is trying to develop plans to figure out a way to be able to put their logo onto the moon itself, onto the surface of the moon, using laser technology. Actually, one of my favorite examples is in boxing. Mike Tyson, the convicted rapist who was fighting in Scotland. This was about 10 years ago. Actually, England wouldn't let him in because they got a rule you can't have convicted rapists come into the country. He was fighting in Scotland. It was part of his comeback, Mike Tyson the boxer, part of his comeback, and he was fighting some no-hoper. His only aim was to get knocked out. So, the manager of Mike Tyson's opponent saw this as a marketing opportunity. So he went to someone and said, you can place an ad on my boxer. Where would you put it? Where would you put them? He's going to get knocked out. The bottom of the feet. If you're not going to be on your feet for very long, that's a good place for it to be. Okay, there is no place that is outside of the realm of commercial marketing. Public bathrooms. Okay, talk about a captive audience. That's exactly what advertisers want. And there are agencies, advertising agencies, who specialize in getting ads out to public bathrooms. A few years ago, the Bamboo Lingerie Company launched a campaign. Actually, it was spray paint on the ground in Manhattan. It said, from here, this is what the spray paint said. It said, from here, it looks like you could use some new underwear. Okay, it should not be surprising. And again, I could carry this on for, for hours, actually. I mean, the outrageous nature of where ads are placed. But it should not be surprising that many commentators now identify the realm of culture as simply an adjunct to the system of production and consumption. Now, the question is, why should this be so? The answer, of course, lies not in advertising. Advertising is merely a tool of something else. The answer lies not in advertising, but in the realm of capitalist production, which revolutionized how human beings interacted with the physical world around them. Capitalism is a revolutionary society in the sense that no society has ever been able to produce as much as capitalism is able to produce. The amount of stuff, that was the great revolution of capitalism. I mean, it's a revolution in terms of relations of production, etc. But it's one of its great revolutions was just its productivity. That fact, the amount of stuff that capitalism produces, that fact now colors the way in which the society presents itself, the way it appears. Objects are everywhere in capitalism. In that sense, as I said, capitalism is truly a revolutionary society, dramatically altering the very landscape of social life in a way no other form of social organization have been able to achieve in such a short period of time. In fact, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, when they wrote the Communist Manifesto, when you read Marx and Engels in the Communist Manifesto, it's tough to know if they're the worst critics of capitalism or its greatest fans, because they love capitalism's dynamism. They saw the development of capitalism, in fact, as essential to getting rid of the vestiges of feudalism before we had what would really come, which was democratic socialism afterwards. Okay, but they loved capitalism dynamism. In fact, they coined the famous phrase, all that is solid melts into air. Capitalism never stands still. Capitalism has to grow, has to keep growing. All that is solid melts into air, to highlight this unique dynamism. In fact, the opening lines of Capital, Volume 1 by Marx, pinpointed the essential feature of the capitalist revolution. Okay, Marx spent, literally decades, studying capitalism, and then he spent a long time trying to figure out how he was going to describe it. And he spent a long time trying to figure out what the starting point would be of his analysis of capitalism. Again, and more people are now starting to realize this, capitalists included, if you want to understand capitalism, Marx is the starting point. Okay? If you want to understand communism, it's not. Marx had nothing to say about communism. He had nothing to say about the horrible societies that would be constructed in his name. I mean, what Marx's great contribution is as an analyst of capitalism and of understanding the logic that drives capitalism. And in fact, the opening lines of Capital, Volume 1, are the following. He says, the wealth of societies in which the capitalist mode of production prevails appears as, quote, an immense collection of commodities. an immense collection of commodities. And he actually puts that in quotes as he's quoting himself from something he wrote before. But he's saying, look, that's the revolutionary aspect of capitalism. It's the amount of stuff, the immense collection of commodities that it is able to produce. So in seeking initially to distinguish his object of analysis from what preceded it, Marx referred to this quantitative dimension. Now, production in one sense has been solved, the problem of production has been solved. It is not, but unfortunately that's not enough. It is not enough only to produce the immense collection of commodities. They must also be sold so that further investment in production is feasible. Once produced, commodities must go through the circuit of distribution, exchange, and consumption so that profit can be returned to the owners of capital and value in a money form. And again, what capitalists do is they take capital, they take money, they invest it in labor, they invest it in materials, they invest it, right? They produce something, and then unless you can sell it at the end, unless you can convert it back into money, that whole process is useless. So consumption is an absolutely key aspect of this. In fact, if it is not completed, the system would collapse into stagnation and depression. Capitalism, therefore, has to ensure the sale of commodities on pain of death. On pain of death. In that sense, the problem of capitalism is not mass production. That's been solved. The problem of capitalism, instead, is the problem of consumption. So central is consumption to its survival and growth that at the end of the 19th century, industrial capitalism invented a unique new institution. That institution was the advertising industry to ensure that the immense collection of commodities are converted back into a money form. The function of this new industry, of the advertising industry, will be to recruit the best creative talent of the society. If you want to know where the best creative talent is, don't go to Hollywood, don't go to novels, that's not where it is. The best creative talent is on Madison Avenue because they're involved in something really difficult. How do you communicate in an environment where people don't want to be communicated to and where everyone is trying to get your attention? That requires creativity. That requires actually the cutting edge creativity. So the function of this new industry will be to recruit the best creative talent of the society and to create a culture in which desire and identity would be fused with commodities. So commodities would not be some peripheral thing. Commodities would be how people thought about their own identities. Because you have to sell this stuff. You can only sell this stuff if identity can be connected to the world of commodities. To make the dead world of things, come alive with human possibilities. Actually, Marx, in chapter 1 of Capital, Marx called this the fetishism of commodities. You've got to take what's dead and you've got to make it come alive. You've got to make it human. You've got to make it part of human identity. You've got to make objects as important to people as other people are. That's partly what he meant by the fetishism of commodities. And indeed, there has never been a propaganda effort to match the effort of advertising in the 20th century and now into the 21st century. More thought, more effort, more creativity, more time, more attention to detail has gone into the selling of the immense collection of commodities than any other campaign in human history to change public consciousness. Religion, possibly, over the centuries. Religion, possibly, might be some competition with advertising. But in terms of the amount of resources that have gone into it, I don't think there is anything that has come close to it. Okay, one indication is simply the amount of money that's spent on it, exponentially that has been spent on advertising. In the United States today, over $200 billion a year is spent on selling us things. And that's just on the advertising industry. That doesn't count what goes into the media. It doesn't count public relations. It doesn't count all the other promotional stuff, just directly what advertising is responsible for. Globally, that is over $400 billion a year. This concentration of effort, I believe, is unprecedented. And the ad messages that are produced, they're not like any other messages. More care and resources are poured into the creation of commercial messages. Okay, there's much more care that goes. If you watch television, compare the ads to the programs. There's about 10 times more effort that goes into the ads than the programming. That's why the programs are so bad and the ads are so good. On a per second basis, 10 times more money goes into advertising than goes into the programming. Ads are made like big budget Hollywood films. I'm not talking about an ad here or there. I'm talking about the average ad is made with the same amount of effort, the same amount of care to detail, the same amount of creativity as Jurassic Park or King Kong or Star Wars or whatever. And, you know, there's a lot of fuss made about these movies that come out. Well, there's an equivalent of that movie and in terms of its concentration of creativity and effort that is everywhere in the culture. And we think it's not important. We think it's just ads. I'm not affected by ads. Actually, if we weren't affected by ads, we would be unique in human history in that we weren't affected by our culture. Everyone is affected by ads. Everyone. It's like the air that we breathe. How can you not be affected by the air that you breathe? This discourse has seeped into our consciousness and our imaginations in ways that we may not even be aware of. I'm going to give you three words, and there's a missing word, fill it in. A, something, is forever. Okay, diamond is forever. That idea, in fact, has conditioned our courtship rituals. Where did that idea come from? Deep in history somewhere as part of tradition? No. That idea was invented in 1948. The N.W. Ayres advertising agency on Madison Avenue. Some copywriter came up with the slogan, a diamond is forever. The major thing people need to know about diamonds, and it's the great secret of the diamond industry, diamonds are not scarce. The reason you buy diamonds is not because they're scarce. The reason you buy diamonds is because there's been literally a giant propaganda effort to convince you that somehow diamonds are connected with love. And that was because diamond sales were flagging in between the two wars, and De Beers, who controls the flow of diamonds globally, you can literally dig diamonds up out of the ground by the ton. There's got to be some other basis on which diamonds have meaning. So they became this symbolic dimension. The aim of the diamond industry is not to dig up diamonds out of the ground. The aim of the diamond industry is to restrict the flow of diamonds. Restrict the flow of diamonds. De Beers has, they've got, I know people start exaggerating this, but they have literally billions of dollars worth of diamonds stockpiled. Their aim is not to get as many diamonds out as possible, right? That's, if it was scarce, as you would do, you dig as much as you can because everyone you dig out is worth a lot. No, that's not diamonds. Diamonds are, you can dig them out by the ton. If you want to make them valuable, you've got to restrict the flow of diamonds. It's actually, I think, the most successful advertising campaign in history and actually part of the biggest scam as well. A diamond is forever. They don't want you to sell your diamonds. Once you've got your diamond, they want you to hang on to it forever because they have more diamonds to sell. As I said, one of the biggest, well, you want to call it a scam, but it's the most successful propaganda effort in history. From a diamond is forever to a world where more kids can recognize Joe Camel and Ronald McDonald than Mickey Mouse and Santa Claus, where the golden arches are more recognizable than the Christian cross. This commercial discourse is the ground on which we live. This commercial discourse is the space in which we learn to think, the lens through which we come to understand the world that surrounds us. Now, if you want to understand the modern world, if you want to understand where we're headed, where we are right now, and you don't put an analysis of advertising and this commercial culture at its center, you're designed to be in ignorance of what drives us. In fact, most of the time, we never pay attention to this commercial environment. In one sense, it kind of disappears from view because it's everywhere. When it's everywhere, you don't pay attention to it. As Marshall McLuhan once said, trying to figure out the influence of media, yeah, we're not too sure who discovered water, but we're pretty sure it wasn't the fish. That is, when it's your environment, it just is. It's the air that you breathe, and therefore you don't pay any attention to it. And the question is, how do you get the fish to pay attention to the water? And how do you get us now to pay attention to this cultural environment? Any theory of modern capitalism, any theory of social change, any attempt at social change that does not take account of the analysis of this commercial culture is doomed to be impotent and marginal, which is where progressive change is, especially in the Western world. Seeking this understanding will involve clarifying what we mean by the power and effectiveness of ads and of being able to pose the right question. If you want to understand something, you've got to ask the right question. For too long, the debate has raged around, or the debate about advertising has been about whether a particular campaign you know, whether it's for Pepsi or Ford or Anheuser-Busch or whatever, whether that campaign makes you buy more of that product. And when we talk about is advertising effective, that's the question we ask. Now, that's an important question if you're Pepsi-Cola or Anheuser-Busch or Ford. But if you're interested in the cultural impact, the social power of advertising, the impact of advertising on society as a whole, that is the wrong question to ask. The right question would ask about the cultural role of advertising, not its narrow marketing role. Culture is the place and space where society tells stories about itself, where values are articulated and expressed, where notions of good and evil, of morality and immorality are defined. Every society has a cultural space. Every society has a space where those stories are told.
This is WXOJLP Northampton and www.activeingredients.org. You are listening to Such Ali speaking at Greenfield Community College, November 18th, 2009, on advertising and material culture.
And in our culture, it's the stories of advertising that dominate the spaces that mediate this function. I think human beings are essentially a storytelling species. If you want to understand the storytelling process in this culture, then you've got to look at the main storytellers. Who tells the stories most of the time? And the storytellers in this culture are those people that have the money. Listen to Deep Throat's advice, follow the money. And what we find in advertising, what we find in commercial culture, in fact, is a very consistent set of stories that are told about how we should live. And so I think the question that we should ask about advertising is not, does it help sell goods? It may not do. Are some campaigns good, some campaigns bad? Yeah, of course, but that's what business schools ask. That's their question. It's not our question. What happens when you ask the wrong question? You're on someone else's terrain. The right question is, what are the values of advertising? What is the morality of advertising? What values does advertising push? What stories does it tell us? So I want to go through the stories. I think you can tell them relatively quickly. The most basic set of stories that it tells us are around happiness. Every society has to have a story about happiness, about how individuals can become happy, feel good subjectively and objectively. And the cultural system of advertising, in fact, gives us a very specific answer to that question for our society. How do you become happy? The way to happiness is through the consumption of objects. Things will make us happy. Commodities will make us happy. And in one very important sense, that is the consistent and explicit message of every single message within the system of market communication. It is better to buy than not to buy. The marketplace is where you will find satisfaction. The marketplace is where you will find identity. The marketplace is what will make you happy. It's a very powerful story to tell. People striving for happiness is a fundamental need that people have. And you can provide this answer. The way to happiness is through what, just coincidentally, capitalism actually produces, which is stuff, things. Start looking at ads from that perspective in terms of what they're saying about human happiness. In fact, we're encouraged to have a deep and intimate relationship with things. If Marx was here and he looked at modern advertising, he would say, that's the fetishism of commodities. They're asking us to have relationships with products as though they're real people, and deep and intimate relationships with people. So economic growth is justified not simply on the basis that it will provide employment, right? Why do we need to make the economy grow, keep growing and growing and growing? Well, one argument could be that it'll provide employment. But, you know, lots of things provide employment. It doesn't just have to be the production of things. The much deeper philosophical justification for economic growth is that more stuff will make us more happy. The more things we have as a society, the happier that we will be. This rationale for the existing system of increasing production is told by advertising in the most compelling form possible. Economic growth equals good. Why? Why is economic growth always equal good? Why is our happiness tied to gross domestic product? Why is it not tied to other things as well that we know are connected to human happiness? If you take GDP as a measure of happiness, it's a very specific way in which happiness is measured. But in fact, it's this story. And this story is what advertising, you know, when I say it is seeped into every nook and cranny of the culture, that is the story that goes with it. Buy, buy, buy. Why? Because it's going to make you happy. Why? Because that's how you can express who you are. Buy, buy, buy. That your inner self will be expressed in the outer world through the objects that we consume. And that story that human happiness is intimately connected to the provisions of the market, to economic growth, I think is the major motivating force for social change on a global scale. It is what is driving economic growth around the world in so-called developing countries, that somehow the marketplace will bring us happiness. The question that we need to pose at this stage, and it's almost never posed, it's a radical question, because if the answer is not what you want it to be, then actually everything else falls apart. And the question, of course, is this true? Does happiness come from material things? Do we get happier as a society as we get richer, as our standard of living increases, as we have more access to the immense collection of objects? Now, obviously, these are complex issues. If I had to answer quickly, the general answer to that question would be, is this true? Do things lead to greater happiness? The answer to that question is no. Actually, I think if I was to ask you that, do you think we as a society are happier now than we were 30 years ago or 50 years ago? Actually, most people have a sense that we're not any happier now, even though our standard of living has increased in absolute terms in pretty spectacular ways. But the level of happiness has not increased. In fact, lots of people have measured this, people who study happiness and satisfaction. It's a great literature. In a series of surveys that have been conducted in the United States starting in 1945, they're called the Happiness Surveys, researchers sought to examine the link between material wealth and its objective happiness. And they've concluded that when examined cross-culturally as well as historically, there is a very weak correlation between economic growth and happiness. I took part in these surveys. You must already have as well. People call you up and they ask you this question. They say, imagine for yourself the best world that you think you could have, the best life you think you could have. You can give that a 10. Imagine for yourself the worst life that you think you could have and give that a 1. So you've constructed your own scale in your head. That's what 1 is, that's what 10 is. And they say, okay, now where would you say you are on that scale? And so you put yourself on that, depending 4, 5, 6 or whatever. And if you do that for this room, we could come up with a happiness index for this room, if everyone did that. And then we could compare it to another room somewhere else. Well, if you do it cross-culturally, and this is what the researchers do, they do it cross-culturally between societies, there is no correlation between richer societies being any happier than poorer societies. There's also no correlation between the question that I posed before. There's no correlation between economic growth historically in one society. So that we're not any happier than we were 30 years ago, even though we're much richer, even though our standard of living is much higher. And the reason for that actually is pretty simple. See, it's actually kind of intuitive as well. Once you get past the nonsense the economic textbooks try and spin you about where happiness comes from, when we think about levels of satisfaction and happiness in terms of where we are, we don't say, wow, look how much wealthier I am than someone in Africa. That's not the comparison we make. We also don't say, well, look how much our standard of living has increased from our parents' generation. Don't look historically either. What we do is we look at this at one time in this society and we compare ourselves to other people. And if the standard of living has gone up for everyone, then the average has gone up for everyone. There's another set of studies as well called the quality of life surveys, where people are asked, what is it that you want out of life? What were important to you? And again, what people answer with, they don't normally answer with material values. They don't say, I want a BMW, I want a big car, or a big house, etc. In fact, when people are asked what it is that makes them happy, what they're looking for human connection, for sociability. They're looking for friendships. They're looking for intimacy. They're looking for sexuality. They're looking for autonomy. They're looking for relaxation. But when you ask people what it is that makes them happy, that's what they respond with. That's not what the society produces. What we produce is stuff. Stuff is not connected to what really makes us happy. It makes us comfortable. We can't live without our stuff. Once we have a little bit of it, we can't do without it. It's the thing, there's no going back. Once you've reached a certain level, then you get used to that. It gives you comfort, but it no longer gives you satisfaction. It no longer gives you happiness. It no longer gives you what it is that people strive for. Okay, these conclusions point to one of the great ironies of the market system. Okay, the market is good at providing those things that can be bought and sold. And it has pushed us via advertising. That's what every ad tells us. Go to the marketplace. Go to the marketplace. Pushes us to a place that cannot provide happiness. Because the real sources of happiness, social relationships, are outside the capability of the market to provide. The marketplace cannot provide love. The marketplace cannot provide real friendships. The marketplace cannot provide sociability. It can provide other material things and services, which we can't do without, but they are not what makes us happy. The ad industry, by the way, has known this since at least the 1920s. In the 1920s, they stopped talking about objects. If stuff was what really made us happy, they talk about objects, how good they were. Well, that's what they did in the first stage of advertising, from about the 1880s to about, you know, somewhere in the 1920s. If you look at advertising at that point, it is all about the products. But starting around the 1920s, that changes. Around the 1920s, what advertisers started to do, and realizing what it is that drove people, they started to take the images of what we say we want and started to connect those to the things they have to sell. So they take the images of the good life. They take the images of friendship. They take the images of sociability. So they start to connect commodities, the things they have to sell, with the powerful images of a deeply desired social life that people say they want. Forget this about products. What are the images that are being used? What are the values that are being sold? And if you look at that, in fact, it is what you would see there will be images of family, images of friendship, images of sociability, images of excitement, images of adventure. And those stories are then linked, those values are then linked to the material world of things. That's why advertising is so attractive. The Beers example I gave before, why did it work? People want love. And the Beers gave us a way that we could have love. It gave us a way in which love could be expressed. It also happened, you know, for the Beers, they were also Monopoly, and there were no other competing stories about what diamonds could mean. And therefore, they were free to give diamonds whatever meaning they wanted to give. But that's why advertising is so attractive, so powerful, so seductive. What it offers us are images of the real sources of human happiness, family life, romance and love, sexuality and pleasure, friendship and sociability, leisure and relaxation, independence and control. That's why it's so powerful. That is what is real about advertising. The cruel illusion of advertising, however, is the way that it links those qualities to a place that by definition cannot provide it, the marketplace and the immense collection of commodities. The falsity of advertising, then, is not in the appeals it makes. The appeals are very real. It's not in the appeals it makes, but in the answers it provides. We want love and friendship and sexuality, and advertising points the way to it. Okay, as one ad executive said, this is Jerry Goodis, if I had to come up with one line to try to describe advertising, this would be it. He says, advertising doesn't mirror how people are acting, but how they are dreaming. Advertising is, in that sense, kind of a dream factory. It taps into our real emotions and repatches them back to us connected to the world of things. It's kind of like the dream life of the culture, taking what it is that is driving people and connects that, as I said, to this world of things. Now, in that sense, you know, advertising's role in this is actually profound. The metaphor I want to use for how advertising works, we'll come back to it later on as well. The metaphor I want to use actually is the metaphor of the drug pusher on the street corner. We know things aren't really connected to happiness. We know that, right? But just as we try and break our addiction to things, it's there on the corner. Go on, one more hit. Go on, one more. Just one more time. It's there on every street corner. And it stops us, in fact, thinking about different ways in which we could possibly think about happiness. Okay, what effect does this have? Well, let me get to the second part of my title. The first effect that it has, I mean, one of the things that it does is it means that we go into enormous debt to try and get the things that we think make us happy. Juliet Shaw, the economist, wrote a really fantastic book called The Overspent American. And that is us. We overspend. We overspend individually, but we overspend systematically as well. Again, we are social creatures. And the way that advertising and media has now fit into this is, in the 40s and 50s, we compared ourselves to the Joneses, keeping up with the Joneses. Well, the Joneses, the life of the Joneses was attainable because they were our next door neighbors. Perhaps they lived in the street over. And so the models of emulation that we had were more realistic. I don't want to say they were realistic, but they were closer to us. We compared ourselves to the next rung of the socioeconomic ladder. Well, what the spread of advertising and the spread of media based on advertising has done, it has dramatically changed that. Because now what normality is not what we have and what our neighbors have. Now what normality is what the top 10% of the population has. Now normality is the lives of the rich and famous. Now normality is the Home and Garden Channel. And we think that is what normal is. And that's who we compare ourselves to. So our reference groups have stretched. And when everyone is comparing themselves, everyone now, only 15% of the population say they would be satisfied with a comfortable life. When the other 85% are now striving towards the top, that is a recipe for disaster. How do you reach that lifestyle? Well, especially when you don't have the money. Well, there's two ways. One, you go into enormous debt, which is what Americans have done, especially when wages have not been increasing as well. And secondly, you work harder. Juliet Child wrote a book called The Overworked American. The book was about how Americans work on average weeks more than their European counterparts do. And then she wrote the second book, she said, why are Americans working so hard? Well, that's the overspent part. They're working hard because they need the money. That is a disastrous situation. The economic crisis we're in, it's not just a financial crisis, it actually is a broad-scale economic crisis. Where it was first indicated? It was in the so-called subprime market, right? It indicated as debt. It was a collapse of debt that was the first indication of what was going on in the economic crisis. So the first effect, as I said, is debt and the kind of way of thinking that comes along with that. The rise in household debt, the largest increases, in fact, in debt are not among the poor, but are those earning between $50,000 and $100,000. Actually, the middle class are really in debt. They're the ones who have the most amount of credit card debt. Credit card debt is like, capitalism is brilliant. But what they did was, starting in the 1970s, American wages, when there were strong unions, actually was pegged very closely to the level of productivity. And wages went up and up and up and up. And what happened in the 1970s was, as productivity kept rising, wages leveled out. However, you now had an American working class that was addicted to a lifestyle that it could no longer afford. So what did capitalism do? Capitalism, it said, okay, instead of paying you wages, we'll lend you money instead. At exorbitant rates. And people went into huge amounts of debt, first on their houses and then onto credit cards. And again, the most important thing you need to know about the credit card industry is they rely upon people having huge amounts of debt. They don't want you to pay your cards off. They don't want you to pay your monthly balances off. In fact, if you pay your monthly balances off and don't pay them any interest, do you know what they call you? You're a deadbeat. Why? Because you're paying off your loans? Yeah, from their purposes, you're a deadbeat because you're not doing what they want to do, which is to pay interest. And they want you to pay interest forever. That is what that minimum payment is. The minimum payment, again, an unbelievable scam. How long would it take you if you make minimum payments on $1,000, and a minimum payment is 2.5%. If you make minimum payments on $1,000 at 19%, how long would it take you to pay off that $1,000? 25 years. The credit card industry, they've fought tooth and nail. Some consumer groups have said, look, why don't you, when you get your bill, why don't you have a line that just says, if you make minimum payments, it will take you this long. Right? Why don't you just give that information? The credit card industry has fought it tooth and nail. But they want minimum payments forever. That's one. Debt has increased. People are in incredible debt. There are incredible crises around debt. There is incredible pressure that comes from being in debt. I mean, being in debt is not a good way to live. Secondly, as I said, the hours of work have risen so that we, over the last 25 years, we work 10% more than we did. The third thing that's happened is the national savings rate has plummeted. Okay, everyone else in the world saves more than we do. That's why we're in debt to the Chinese. And they're the fastest growing economy, but they also save, and they have money that they lend us. In fact, one of the statistics that Julia Chor gives is on this. She says, it's actually a frightening statistic. And this actually was before the economic crisis, it'd be even worse now. 60% of American families only have enough savings to last them 1 month if they were to lose their jobs. 60% of Americans are 1 month away from disaster. Think of the anxiety that causes. Think of what employers can get people to do when they're held in with that much insecurity. It's also affected what we call the public purse and collective consumption. And so we're much less willing to pay public services. I mean, I wish people would really be upset as to where federal dollars were going. Because actually, we pay a lot of money, but where does the federal dollars go? Mostly into the military-industrial complex. And we have more than enough money to pay for a system of national health care and education, et cetera. We're not encouraged to think about the taxes at that level. We only think about taxes at the local level. We only think about taxes at the state level. The taxes that actually give you something, the taxes that actually provide you with services, are the ones that there is most resistance to. And again, that is very deliberately done. We care less about society. And part of the reason for that is the commercial culture tells us that you are what you buy, that your major identity is an individual identity, is not connected to other things. That's what this commercial culture tells us. That's what these stories that link happiness to things tell us. In fact, Margaret Thatcher, again, she gave the best articulation to this, the logic of advertising makes its way into politics. Margaret Thatcher said, and she was not misquoted, this is exactly what she meant, she said, quote, "There is no such thing as society. There are just individuals and their families." Okay, the market appeals to the worst in us. The market appeals to greed, it appeals to selfishness, and discourages what is the best about us: compassion, caring, and generosity. Questions about collective issues are pushed to the margins of the culture. I mean, the disillusionment with government. Government has been turned into the enemy. Now, I realize it can be the enemy. Right now, it is the only institution that has any kind of democratic sense built into it. And yet, it's been turned into the enemy. So most people are encouraged not to vote. And then we're encouraged to elect people like Republicans who don't believe in government. So those collective issues, in fact, have been marginalized. Unfortunately, we are now in a situation, both globally and domestically, where solutions to pressing nuclear and environmental problems will have to take a collective form. The marketplace cannot deal with the problems that face us at the turn of the millennium. The marketplace cannot deal with global warming. The marketplace cannot deal with the running out of resources, cannot deal with peak oil. The marketplace can't deal with threat of nuclear extermination. There are more nuclear weapons now than there ever were. The threat of nuclear extermination has not gone away, and the marketplace cannot deal with it. As the environmentalists say, we all live downstream now. But we have to find collective answers to this, and yet the major force at the center of the society tells us exactly the opposite, relegates discussion of collective issues to the peripheries of the culture, and instead talks in powerful ways of individual desire and fantasy and pleasure and comfort. What other effects? I'll just go through these quickly. I mean, I'm sure many people are aware of this, the other major environmental effects on resources and global warming. I have my students watch Al Gore's film, An Inconvenient Truth. I think it's a very good film in one level in terms of laying out the problem. It's just terrible when it comes to how you fix it. If you look at the film, you know, what do you do when you fix it at the end? It's got in the credits, change light bulbs. And Gore refuses to answer what needs to fix it. Which needs to fix it is a new system of production. The reason we have global warming and the reason we are running out of oil is because of the way in which we produce. And what was needed is not changes the level of individual consumption. What is needed is a fundamental shift. What will drive us? What will motivate us to think in these ways? I mean, again, it's important to avoid the prediction of immediate catastrophe. We've done a lot of damage, but the real environmental crisis will not hit us until sometime, you know, in the middle of the century, another 30, 40, 50 years or so. The real environmental crisis won't hit anyone in this room. We'll all die and the world will still be there in pretty much the form that, the younger ones of you, that may not be the case. And the question is, when the damage is going to be so far away, when how do you reach across generations? How do you make that connection to generations not yet born? We have to do that now. We have to make those changes. We have to avoid the catastrophe. We have to take steps now. The best metaphor for this that describes this is if you think of an oil tanker heading for a crash on the shore. An oil tanker, right, is so big, the momentum of it, you have to start turning well before there seems to be any imminent danger.